because it is the ultimate principle of being, beyond being, whatever exactly that means, but nonetheless the cause of being. Ontological means just that, related to being. The good has fundamental epistemological significance. This is the word derived from the Greek episteme, meaning knowledge. The good is what makes knowledge possible because it is what makes truth possible. Knowledge and truth go hand in hand. When I know something, I'm able to make true statements about it, and somehow the idea of the good is the cause of truth. Third, the idea of the good is good, which suggests, of course, that it is the source of all value in the world. The good, in short, has fundamental moral significance. Another way to put this point is that, according to Plato, the entire world is somehow good, because the idea of the good is the cause of it. It's a very weighty and controversial notion, one, however, well worth thinking about it. Indeed, much of the history of philosophy has done just that since Plato. Think about it. Another way I perhaps can shed some light on Plato's idea of the good is to make a comparison, one that he himself couldn't make. And that is to compare the idea of the good to the biblical God, to God as found in both the Old and New Testaments. Indeed, God as found in the Quran. In other words, the God of all the great monotheistic religions. Religious thinkers for hundreds, if not thousands of years, have long felt an affinity with Plato. And that's because there are real similarities between the idea of the good and God. Those similarities, I hope, you can extract from my earlier comments. The good and God are ultimate principles. They are absolute. They have fundamental ontological and moral significance. They are perfect. They are eternal. They are immaterial. You can't touch the idea of the good with your hands or see it with your eyes. Nor, of course, can you touch God with your hands. God is absolute in the Bible. One quick example of a religious thinker who, in thinking about Plato, found an ally was the great Christian philosopher and theologian, St. Augustine. He lived from approximately 350 to 430. That is in the Common Era. He was decisively influenced by Platonism. In fact, he credits reading Plato with helping him to become a Christian. Before reading Plato, he was a typical Roman pagan. Plato turned him towards this great spiritual reality of the good, and this helped prepare Augustine to be converted to Christianity. That's by his own account. So those are the similarities between the biblical God and the idea of the good. There are profound differences as well. Once again, St. Augustine, and I would recommend his book, The Confessions, for this issue, he makes it very clear that as appreciative as he was of Platonism and its affinity with religion, he understood full well the very basic differences. In a nutshell, the difference is this. Philosophers in Plato's Republic love the good, but the good doesn't love them back. The good is completely impersonal. The good has no concern whatsoever for human affairs. The good did not create the universe. If anything, and this is a comparison that will be very important as we move to the very end of Book 6 and all of Book 7, if anything, the good is like a number. A number is an intelligible structure, but a number has no feelings, no personality, 100% impersonal. The biblical God, however it's approached, and of course, centuries of debate about the biblical God, in one way or another, is personal. Whether God gives us his Son, or gives us the Ten Commandments, or speaks to the prophet, in all of those cases, God is concerned with the world, not the idea of the good. This is why St. Augustine rejects Platonism. Very appreciative, but finally critical, because it doesn't have this loving God at its pinnacle. Let me close this lecture with some speculation about why Socrates says so little of detail about the idea of the good. We know a lot about it. On the one hand, I hope my lecture has given you some indication of what it is, but my lecture has not given you enough, and I'm the first to admit that, and I'm not embarrassed because Socrates doesn't give us enough. He simply doesn't say very much. This section in the Republic that concerns the idea of the good is a tiny, tiny fraction of the whole Republic, even though the idea of the good is far and away the most important principle of the whole Republic. There are a few reasons why, and I'll just speculate and suggest them to you and ask you to think about it yourself. I've already suggested one. Perhaps the idea of the good, according to Plato, is finally inaccessible, not completely knowable. And perhaps this is why Socrates is rather silent about it. A second reason. Maybe Glaucon, as well as Adeimantus and Polemarchus, the young people surrounding Socrates, are just too young, too inexperienced, not sufficiently philosophically sophisticated yet to understand the idea of the good. If you read the text carefully, you'll see that Socrates himself suggests as much at a couple of critical junctures. Now, if that's the case, then I offer you my third suggestion. Why would Plato have written this dialogue between Socrates, an older man, and these younger men who are incapable of fully understanding what the idea of the good is? I think the reason might be this, and this is my own suggestion. Please take it as that. Perhaps the main purpose in writing a dialogue for Plato, the idea of the good in the Republic in particular, is to get us, the readers, to think for ourselves. In other words, I believe there are two dialogues going on in any Platonic dialogue, the Republic perhaps most dramatically. The first dialogue is between Socrates and Glaucon. That's the overt, dramatic dialogue. But the second, much more important dialogue is between Plato and us. Perhaps the message that Plato finally is trying to communicate is this: if you want to be a philosopher and understand the idea of the good, you must think for yourself.
These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by The Teaching Company. These lectures are titled Plato's Republic, Part 2. Lecture 13, Book 6, The Divided Line.
In the previous lecture, we discussed the famous, or perhaps the infamous, idea of the good. This is Plato's supreme principle. It's the supreme principle of reality, of being, and of knowledge, and of truth. It's a terribly obscure passage, as we saw. It's obscure not because the descriptions of it are so extraordinarily complicated. In fact, they're not. What they are is extraordinarily sparse. Socrates, in fact, tells us very little about the idea of the good. In the last lecture, I gave you a couple of speculations as to why Plato writes this scene in this way. Perhaps I suggested he's trying to provoke the reader into thinking for himself or for herself. Those were speculations and no more. Socrates himself acknowledges that this discussion of the idea of the good is obscure or is at least insufficient. His colleague, Glaucon, is puzzled. And of course, why shouldn't he be? It's a terribly puzzling description. So Socrates tries to help out. And he helps out by means of an image, the image that's become known by scholars as the divided line, which will be the focus of today's lecture. I need to warn you in advance that once again, we will be in some murky waters. This is a very difficult passage to understand. It's again very sparse. When you read it on your own, you'll perhaps be surprised by how quickly it goes by, and you won't really be able to understand each and every move that Socrates makes. I'll do my best to try to explain. At the same time, I'll also have to do some interpreting in this passage. I'll alert you when I'm offering you some of my own views about how to understand the divided line. Socrates gives Glaucon instructions about how to draw a certain line. In ancient Greece, they had no blackboards, they had no projectors. So the line probably would have been drawn in the sand, right at their feet. So let's try to imagine these instructions being given to us. In fact, you could even follow these instructions yourself at home with just paper and pencil. Take a line and divide it into two unequal sections. Socrates doesn't tell us which of the sections, the top section or the bottom section, and notice I'm assuming that the line is vertical. We learn later that it is vertical, but actually here in this passage, Socrates doesn't even tell us that it's vertical. Again, however, we'll assume it is, and we get evidence for this later. We have our vertical line. We cut it into two segments, unequal segments. And then we cut each of the unequal segments again, following the same proportion of the original cut. What you have before you, if you have undergone this exercise with Socrates, is a line with four sections. We can label the top section A, then B, then C, and the bottom section can be labeled D. One of the things you'll notice right away on your drawing, even if you did it very quickly, is that the two middle sections, regardless of how you cut the line yourself, are equal. We can prove this. In the translation I use, that by Alan Bloom, in his notes, he shows you the proof. Whatever translation you are using, likely you'll find this discussion in the notes. The two middle sections are equal, and that turns out, on my interpretation of the divided line, to be very important. The line is vertical, therefore it has a left side and a right side. And Socrates labels each of these four segments and each side of the line. On the left side, we find objects. The objects are as follows, and you can follow this as I diagram it in the booklet that accompanies the course. If you're using Alan Bloom's translation, as I am, you'll see this is similar to the drawing he uses. Any translation, again, that you're using will likely have a figure accompanying this passage of the Republic. On the left, at the top, this would be section A, are forms. In Greek, the word is eidē. You see that in the booklet. That's the plural of eidos. Section B, the second segment, mathematical objects. Section C, below that, sensible things. Section D, the very bottom on the left, images or icons. I pronounced that word, you see the Greek in the booklet, to remind you that's the root of our word, indeed, icon or image. On the right side of the line, corresponding to each of these four objects, is a psychological or cognitive state which is responsible for apprehending the object. Corresponding to forms on the left is intellection on the right. The Greek is pronounced noesis. Corresponding to mathematical objects on the right is thought, dianoia. Corresponding to sensible things is trust. In Greek, the word is pistis. And corresponding to images is imagination, eikosia. This is all very mysterious at this point. Let's try to figure it out. A very great scholar whose name was Jacob Klein, his work you'll find in the bibliography in the booklet, made a suggestion about how to understand the divided line, which I have long followed, and I will be imitating his argument in the way I present the material that I hope will elucidate the meaning of the divided line. Klein's suggestion is that the key to understanding the divided line is to start at the bottom with images. So let's think about images for just a couple of minutes. We need to think about images, D on the left at the bottom, in relationship to C, sensible things, which are above the images. The key point is this. An image is an image of something. Best example, the example Socrates himself uses, is a shadow. A shadow is an image of a sensible thing which is responsible for producing the shadow. An example that would come very quickly to our minds, of course, would be a photograph. If I take a picture of you with a camera, the picture is the image. You are the original. You are a sensible thing, a real thing, and the image is an image of you. I mentioned that this line needs to be vertical, and the reason why is because sensible things are higher than images. Now, what does higher mean? It means that images are dependent upon sensible things. If I remove my hand, there is no shadow. It doesn't work the other way around. If I cut off the light source, there's no shadow, but there's still a hand. The sensible original is responsible for the image. The image is dependent on the original. Klein's thesis, which I believe is accurate, is that this relationship between image and original works its way through the entire divided line. Let's move up to see what that means. Sensible things, my hand, the chair, the table, are themselves images of mathematical objects. In terms of the diagram that you have in your booklet, sensible things are segment C, mathematical objects, segment B. That is not an obvious description, is it, to say that sensible things are images of mathematical objects. In fact, it's a rather difficult move to understand. But let me offer you this suggestion, this example, as a way of thinking about this. Let's just pick a number, the number 3. The number 3 is capable of counting 3 apples, or 3 oranges, or 3 grapefruits, or 3 tables. The number 3 remains the same. The number 3 is not something we can touch with our hands or see with our eyes. It's a concept. It's an intelligible structure. The chairs, the tables, the oranges, the apples, they can all change. I can substitute an apple for an orange. The apple can go bad or become rotten and actually disappear, but the number three remains constant. The number three, you might say, has a kind of power that sensible things don't have. And this is the sense in which sensible things are themselves images of higher originals, namely mathematical objects. This is still, I would guess, rather difficult to follow. Numbers, according to Plato, are responsible for sensible things being intelligible. He would argue, and he may well be right, that the world of our senses, the world that comes into our eyes and we feel with our hands, would simply make no sense whatsoever unless we could count. He takes counting very, very seriously. And you'll see in the next couple of lectures that mathematics, arithmetic in particular, will start to gain more and more prominence in Plato's Republic. Once again, mathematical objects, and we'll focus exclusively for an example on numbers, are higher than sensible objects. Sensible objects are images. If this is true, and I would ask you to entertain this possibility for the next few minutes, an extraordinary thing has happened. The sensible world, the world that we normally think of as being real, the world we're most comfortable with, the world which we trust, that's the word that is on the right side of the line corresponding to sensible things, that world that we typically take for granted has become transformed as we moved from C to B. It has become transformed into an image. Go back to the bottom of the line to understand what this means. The shadow is an image of the hand. The hand is more real than the shadow. I know that because if I remove the hand, the shadow disappears. The shadow depends on the hand for its reality. Socrates is making the extraordinary suggestion that the sensible world is like a shadow. It's dependent on a higher form of reality. And in this case, in this particular segment of the divided line, that form of reality is mathematical. This is an extraordinary discovery on Plato's part. And you'll perhaps recall a point I made when I asked you to actually draw the divided line yourself. The two segments of the divided line that are in the middle, B and C, are equal. Regardless of how you divide the line, they always have to be equal. I think this is a point that Plato is trying to communicate. It's a point that was made much, much later by someone like the great physicist Galileo. Galileo famously said, "The book of nature is written in the characters of mathematics." What did he mean by that? He meant, I think, precisely what Socrates means here, that the sensible world, the world that we observe, is itself structured by mathematical principles. The deeper reality of the sensible world is found not in what we can touch with our hands, but what we can think with our minds, and principally what we can think by way of mathematics. Corresponding to mathematical objects on the right side of the line is that word thought. This is how we access reality. Again, a rather puzzling idea that we don't get our basic contact with reality with our senses, we get it with our minds. A fundamental tenet of Platonism. We move up the line. We move from segment B to segment A, from mathematical objects to forms. We've already talked a lot about forms in this course. Here they are at the top of the divided line, although not at the very top. very close to the top. Unfortunately, once again, Socrates is very reticent about the relationship between forms and mathematical objects. But we can infer what he means if, once again, we take our bearings from the bottom of the line. His point, I believe, is this. Mathematical objects, which are the originals of which sensible things are images, are themselves images of forms. Forms are the higher level of reality, the more basic originals of which mathematical objects are merely images. The divided line, in short, is a very compact picture of all of reality. At the top of the ontological hierarchy, ontological is the word that is derived from the Greek word for being, are the forms. I'm not going to try to explain any further the relationship between forms and mathematical objects. This is a theme we will come back to shortly, however. At the very top of the divided line, what do we find? Socrates doesn't quite say it explicitly, but he clearly intends it. This is, of course, the idea of the good. So now, pushing our idea of image and original to the top of the divided line, we can say what? That even forms, the form of beauty, the form of justice, the subject of the Republic itself, even these forms are images of the highest principle of all, the idea of the good. As we know, and we discussed in the previous lecture, we're just not sure what Plato means by the idea of the good. Many commentators throughout the history of philosophy have made a suggestion that's plausible but certainly not provable, and that is that the idea of the good is what came to be known as the one, the principle of unity. This is an attractive proposal if you think in the following terms. The idea of the one is itself responsible for the possibility of any number. If I have the number three, I can conceive of the number three as three ones. In Greek arithmetic, ancient Greek arithmetic, one was not a number. The first number was two. And that's because in the Greek mind, a number was a number of ones. If I count three apples, an apple is functioning as my unit, and I count one, two, three apples. The unit must come first. And I think this might be the reasoning behind those commentators who believe that the idea of the good is really the one. That before we can even begin to think, either mathematically or in terms of forms, we must begin with the idea, the most basic idea of all, which is the idea of the unit, of oneness. If this is true, then we will identify the one as the ultimate principle responsible for the intelligibility of all of the rest of reality. This is still, needless to say, rather hard to understand. And Socrates appreciates that. One of the great benefits of writing a dialogue, as Plato does, is by giving Socrates a conversation partner, in this case Glaucon, he often will have Glaucon ask questions, the very same questions we readers ourselves would likely ask. And Glaucon doesn't understand everything that Socrates has been saying. Later, and I refer here to 523 C to D, which is in Book 7, the divided line, you recall, occurs at the very end of Book 6. Socrates tries to explain the divided line a little bit more elaborately, and he gives an example. He asks us to imagine three fingers. The pinky finger is the littlest finger, the ring finger is in between, And then the middle finger is the largest finger. You don't have to think about this in terms of fingers. Just imagine, again, you might even want to sketch with pencil and paper three lines where you go from the shortest to the middle to the longest line. The key point Socrates makes here is that the finger in the middle, and when I say middle, I'm not referring to the middle finger, I'm referring to the in-between finger, the finger that's larger than the smallest and smaller than the largest. That finger, if I simply look at it with my eyes, is both larger and smaller, longer and shorter. Socrates identifies this as a contradiction. This doesn't make sense. How can something be both longer and shorter? His point that he makes in Book 7 is that with my eyes alone, with my senses, I cannot resolve this contradiction. And you can prove this by just looking at those three little lines you drew with a pencil and paper and just focus. First, I look at the middle line in relationship to the smaller and then in relationship to the bigger. And you'll, of course, see exactly what Socrates means. That middle line is both longer and shorter. And that's a contradiction. And a contradiction, according to Socrates, doesn't make sense. Another way to put this point then is that the information we get with our eyes by itself just doesn't make sense. So what do? We need to stabilize, we need to make intelligible what is otherwise unintelligible on the level of sensation. And how do we do it? Very easily, very commonsensically. We measure the three fingers or the three lines that you've drawn. And we'll say that the smallest is 2 inches long, the middle is 3 inches long, and the longest is 4 inches long. 2, 3, 4 inches. Now, having made that measurement, my otherwise contradictory sensations have been resolved. They've been rendered intelligible. They've been stabilized. What had been unintelligible is now intelligible. This is a way of going back to the divided line and recall what corresponds to sensible things on the right is trust. What we normally trust to be reliable is the information we get from our senses. Socrates' point is that's just not the way it is. What's much more reliable is the way we think about the information we receive from our senses. That primary act of thinking is found in counting, in measuring. By establishing the exact length of the three fingers or the three lines, I am moving upwards from C to B. I'm realizing that numbers are actually more powerful in explaining reality than what I receive through my eyes. This very simple act, utterly commonsensical, is in fact of fundamental philosophical importance for Plato. It suggests the point I made earlier, that the sensible world itself is but an image of a higher reality. Now, let me go back to the observation I made about the geometry of the line, namely that those two middle sections are equal. Once we have moved up from sensible things to mathematical objects, the two segments that are exactly equal in length, there's a very great temptation. It's a temptation we all know. It's the temptation to go back down. The reason why we're so tempted to go back down is because, as we all know, mathematics is so remarkably useful in explaining, even manipulating, the sensible world. If I'm a carpenter and I know a little bit about geometry, I'm able to use that knowledge to help me build a house. If I'm a merchant and I know arithmetic, I can use that knowledge to help me make money. On a vastly more sophisticated level, I will return to my comparison with Galileo. In mathematical physics, I learn my mathematics. I learn the laws of nature, which are mathematical, and I can return to the sensible world and know how it works and be able to manipulate it. This going back down from B to C, I like to think of as intellectual gravity. The weight of thinking seems to pull us downwards precisely because mathematics is so useful in manipulating the sensible world. Socrates gives a word to describe this tendency of thought. He calls it the technai, the arts, the crafts. That word is the root of our word technology or technical. His point then is that technical thinking is the application of mathematics to the sensible world in order to achieve useful practical results. Again, I would use the phrase intellectual gravity to describe this tendency to move from B to C. The point Socrates wants to make, however, is that the goal of the philosopher is to reverse intellectual gravity and to go upwards rather than downwards. Instead of moving from mathematical objects back down to sensible things, to move upwards from mathematical objects to the forms, to turn around. And I use that phrase with some emphasis because this will become very important in our next lecture when we discuss in some detail the Platonic conception of education. The goal of the philosopher is to resist a temptation. It's the temptation to use the results of thinking to achieve practical results in the sensible world. The name Socrates gives for this upward thrust of intellectual labor is dialectic. You'll see that at 5.11b. The challenge is to go upwards from mathematical objects to the forms, to the very top of the line, the idea of the good, and then, and I'm going to quote 5.11c, to work our way all the way back down the entire line, making no use of anything sensed in any way, but using forms themselves, going through forms, to forms, it ends in forms too. Again, it's very difficult to understand exactly what Socrates means. I've read this passage hundreds of times, and I'm not sure. I will confess that. However, I think at least we can get a sense of what he means. Dialectic is the process of completely reversing intellectual gravity, understanding that even mathematics are merely images of higher intelligible realities, the forms, which themselves are images of the good or perhaps the one. Upon understanding that, working our way down through all the remaining categories or segments of reality and giving an explanation of everything in terms of those higher principles. In short, the divided line seems to offer an image of philosophy itself. It suggests the possibility of a formal articulation of the whole of reality. One clue as to what this might mean in more concrete terms. Let's go back to the very beginning of the Republic when Socrates asks Cephalus what seems to be such a simple question. He asks him, what is justice? And we've discussed this idea several times in the course already. That question is a way of looking for the form of justice. That is a question that is seeking a universal definition, an intelligible structure. It's a question which disparages the particulars. The particulars are those individual sensible things that come into being and then pass away, trees and dogs and cats, apples and oranges. Those, in a very important sense, are of little interest to Socrates. What he's interested in is the formal structure, the intelligible structure of reality, and not the particulars that seem to populate reality. That he relegates to the level merely of sense.
Lecture 14, Book 7, The Parable of the Cave.
The last two lectures have been remarkably abstract. It's easy, perhaps, to forget that this dialogue is titled The Republic. The Greek word is politeia, related to our word politics. It's a very reasonable question to ask at this stage of our study. What in the world does all this abstract philosophizing have to do with politics? What does it have to do with justice? Socrates, at the beginning of Book 7, begins the process of answering that question, of returning us to the basic issues of politics. He does so here at the beginning of Book 7 by reciting what has become one of the most famous little stories or parables in the history of Western philosophy. It's the parable of the cave, and it runs from 514a to 521b. This is a story that many high school students study, and it's well known to many people throughout all levels of education. And I use the word education there deliberately, because the cave, says Socrates, is meant to be an image of education. We know from the very beginning of the Republic that education has been a major concern of Socrates's. The cave is an image of it. It's a way of summarizing his basic thoughts about education. Construct the following image in your minds. Use your imagination and imagine prisoners in a cave. Their legs and their necks are shackled, and as a result, they are unable to turn their heads. They're forced to look in one direction only, at the wall in front of them. On the wall in front of them are projected images. These images are generated by puppets, which are behind them. They can't see these puppets because their necks are shackled. There is a fire behind these puppets, which is casting the shadows on the wall. Very strange image. As always, whatever you end up thinking about Plato as a philosopher, you won't be able to deny the fact that he's a marvelous writer, and in this case, he's a marvelous storyteller. These are very strange people down at the bottom of a cave. Nonetheless, says Socrates, they are like us. He uses those exact words at 515a. In what conceivable way could they be like us? Well, I think we're prepared to answer that question because we've just studied the divided line, and we paid particular attention to the issue of images. These prisoners who are like us are seeing images. They, because they can't turn their heads, don't know that they're seeing images. They think they're seeing reality when, in fact, all that is in front of them are shadows. They are like us because we treat the sensible world in the same way. We ordinary people tend to believe that what we can touch with our hands, see with our eyes, is reality. You recall from the divided line that corresponding to sensible objects on the left side of the line is trust on the right side. I think now we're in a position to understand that word. We trust reality. We trust the reports that we get from our senses and believe that what we're seeing actually exists. But in doing so, we're like prisoners who are trapped in the world of images. We just don't know that they are images. One way of thinking about the cave is to imagine a movie theater. Very similar, actually. If you think of a darkened movie theater, everybody is looking at the screen, the projector is behind them. As the movie gets more and more enthralling, you absolutely forget that there's a projector behind you, and you are treating these images, this spectacle in front of your eyes, as if it were reality. This is why we can cry or cheer at a movie. We forget it's only an image. I make this comparison between the parable of the cave and the modern day movie theater because certainly in our day and age, we live in a world that's increasingly dominated by images. If Plato were to appear on our streets in today's world, I think he'd be just astonished at the ubiquitous presence of images. Of course, we spend so much time on our computers, on the internet, on TV, with DVDs. We are very easily trapped into thinking that these images that we see with our eyes are in fact reality. Plato would caution us and say, be careful. Don't become intoxicated with your images. Don't become so dependent on your screens. As a university professor, I'm always struck by the need that modern day students have for visual images to accompany lectures. They're very impatient with lectures that don't have all sorts of spectacle going on with it. Education for Socrates is turning around. This is the dominant metaphor of the parable of the cave. You will perhaps even remember the very beginning of Plato's Republic. Socrates is headed home to Athens proper, and he is forced to turn around and come back into the Piraeus with Polemarchus. As often is the case in Book One, that was a foreshadowing of the story of the cave. The main idea that Socrates tries to communicate in his imagery of education is that it requires a certain kind of force. A prisoner, and we're all prisoners, prisoners of images, a prisoner must be compelled, a word you find at 515c, to stand up and turn around and start to make his or her way out of the cave. Obviously, there has to be a compulsion of some sort because, for one thing, these prisoners have been locked into their positions. They need assistance in unloosening their bonds. And it's going to be very painful. Just treat this image at face value for a second. And you'll know, of course, if you've been sitting a long time and if your head hasn't been turning, if you've been, for example, on an airplane for a long flight, it's very painful to get up and move around. It's painful at first. And that is, says Socrates, exactly what education is like. It's painful. It's painful for another reason. When this prisoner is liberated by some sort of teacher and forced to turn around and start to make way upwards out of the cave, the prisoner will see the puppets and the prisoner will see the fire that is casting the shadows. And this is going to be painful in more than one sense. It's going to be painful because the light from the fire will be rather difficult to look at. You know what happens when you move from a darkened space into a more illuminated space. It hurts your eyes. It will be painful in another, deeper sense, however. It will be painful because the prisoner who is now liberated will realize that what he had taken to be reality, these images flickering before his eyes, wasn't reality at all. This is a terrible experience that students have to go through. They have to realize that what they thought was true is in fact not true. What they thought was real perhaps isn't so real. What they thought was reality, in fact, was only an image. Exactly the language we were developing in our study of the divided line. In fact, says Socrates, 515e, the prisoner has to be dragged out of the cave. Once reaching the top, getting into the surface of the earth, the prisoner will be bathed in sunlight. And this, again, will be terribly painful. The sun, of course, is even much brighter than the fire. It will take a while for the prisoner's eyes to become adjusted to the bright light. Eventually, those eyes will become accustomed to it. And at that point, the prisoner is no longer a prisoner. The prisoner sees reality for what it is. The prisoner will see trees and animals and the moon and the stars, and in fact, eventually, will even be able to glimpse the sun itself. You remember our discussion of the idea of the good. The sun is, Socrates says, the child of the good. The sun is analogous to the good. This is clearly at work in the cave story. The process of education starts at the bottom of the cave, where we are only surrounded by images. It ends up traversing the various stages of the divided line until we reach the top, the sun, or analogously, the idea of the good. I think it's important here to take a step back and reflect on this metaphor that Socrates develops in order to express his conception of education. Education is turning around. Let me suggest to you a competing image of education, which I think will shed some light on Socrates' conception of education. This is, I would say, unfortunately, the image of education we live with in our time. I think for us, education tends to be conceived as the reception of information. We live, we're told many, many times, in the information age. You can go on to your internet connection and get all the information you want. The computer is astonishing at providing it for us. I sometimes think of this conception of education as the empty head conception of education. Think of your head being opened up and information, data, facts are just poured into the empty head. Very often students who are quite accustomed to this model of education will sit rather passively in a university course and just take notes. They are accustomed to the professor dispensing facts, dispensing little tiny bits of wisdom which they receive. The Socratic model is very different. This is a conception of education as turning around. This is a conception of education as revolutionary, because that, in fact, is what revolution means, a turning around. It's a conception of education that requires great struggle and, in fact, requires pain. You remember that this prisoner has to be dragged out of the cave. What that suggests is that the Socratic goal of education, and I believe we already know this about Socrates from our studies so far, is to make us uncomfortable, uncomfortable with conventional reality, uncomfortable with traditional opinions. The overwhelming philosophical demand is to think for oneself. And this is not easy, because when you think for yourself, you challenge conventional wisdom, you try to move upwards on the divided line, you are unwilling to treat images as reality and demand that reality be treated as reality. I think this is a very useful way of shedding some light on Socrates as a character in Plato's dialogue. Socrates, as we now know, is a rather strange person. I would take you all the way back to the opening scene of the Republic for a reminder. The first thing he does when he meets the old man Cephalus is to ask him, what's it like to be so old? How does it feel to be close to death? A question that conventional manners would certainly prohibit most of us from asking. Socrates is aggressive. At times, he's almost crude in the bluntness of his questioning. I think we now can get a sense of why he acts this way. He is trying to destabilize us. He's trying to shake us up, get us to think for ourselves, get us to make a break with what everybody else has been telling us. If Socrates would appear on our streets today, I think he would say, especially to young people, unplug those computers of yours. They're wonderful at dispensing little bits of information. Very impressive tools indeed. However, that's not the same thing as thinking. Real thinking goes on inside of your minds. It requires effort. It requires even this painful procedure that's described in the cave. After the prisoner is fully liberated and is bathing in the sunshine of the real world on top, something strange again happens. The liberated prisoner is compelled, 519c, to return to the cave in order to share his illumination. The cave is perhaps the single best story in the history of Western philosophy that expresses the theme of enlightenment. And I mean with that word something very literal, bringing light. The prisoner is forced to return to the cave in order to shed light in that darkness. This is, of course, the philosopher king, the philosopher queen. We have been talking about such a person for some time now. This is the person, the philosopher, who understands the idea of the good, which is mimicked by the sun in the parable of the cave, and who brings that understanding into the cave, or, to put it another way, into the city, the polis, in order to help bring the polis up, to bring justice, to bring goodness, to make it a better place. Glaucon, who is never reluctant to ask a hard question, objects. And he says, "Wait a minute, Socrates, isn't this rather unfair to the philosopher? We're forcing the philosopher, who is bathing in the sunshine, to go back into this dark, smoky cave. Aren't we," Glaucon asks, and I'm referring to line 519d, "aren't we doing the philosopher an injustice? We're making him or her do something that's contrary to their nature." Perhaps you remember that a basic principle of Socrates' city, and this goes all the way back to the first city that we discussed in Book 2, is the idea of the division of labor. You recall the simplest city has only 4 or 5 people, the shoemaker, the farmer, the carpenter. And the shoemaker must be good at making shoes. We would never ask a shoemaker to become a carpenter, and we wouldn't ask a carpenter to become a farmer. Implicit in Glaucon's question, then, is the objection that the philosopher is being treated unfairly or unjustly because he or she is now being required to do 2 jobs. First job is to be a philosopher. It's a very hard job. You have seen some of the difficulties involved with it by reading the divided line and the idea of the good passages. The second job that the philosopher is now being forced to do is to rule the city. So which is it? What is the philosopher's job? Is it to be a philosopher or to rule the city? It's not just, Glaucon says, to ask philosophers to do both. Some commentators believe that this is actually a fatal flaw in Plato's entire project, and we'll come back to that issue. Perhaps you can imagine Socrates' response to Glaucon's objection, very similar to his reasoning that we've encountered many times in the Republic. He says to Glaucon, "The happiness of any one individual, whether it's the philosopher or anyone else, is not my concern. I'm trying to construct a just city, a perfectly good city, and my overriding concern is the goodness of the whole, not the goodness of any individual. So if the philosopher would rather